We're here today with Mark Lieb. He's had a fascinating career as a naval aviator, in a big helicopter that during the Vietnam War and probably other occasions, he worked for search and rescue to find down pilots, things of that nature. At what point in your life did you decide, you know what I want to be is a naval aviator? What point did you decide you wanted to do that?
That's a great question. But by the way, the last name is Liebman, not Lieb.
Yeah.
But that's okay. So actually, I've always wanted to be a military pilot. And I fell in love with aircraft carriers probably around the age of 4 or 5. My parents were visiting New York City. And outside in the window of my grandparents' house, you could see the Navy shipyard, the Brooklyn Navy shipyard. And they were building at the time what apparently was ultimately going to become the USS Constellation. But I've always wanted to be a military pilot. And my father was a career Air Force officer. And it came time to go off to college. The Navy was the only one that would guarantee me flight training, that in the Army. And I didn't like the idea of camping. I camped as a Boy Scout, but you know, I'm talking about camping for long periods of time. So, the Navy guaranteed me flight training, assuming I could pass the physical and the mental exams, and the rest is history.
Yeah. So the Navy did a pretty good job of getting you, trained and gave you an opportunity, I assume, to go to other countries and take part in operations there that were important to the Navy.
Yeah. The Navy gave me a wonderful opportunity to go out to what our former president called feces holes.
Yeah.
I've been to some really neat places in the Navy, and I've been to some places that I would prefer not to return to.
Hmm. What's your favorite European country that you visited?
Oh, wow. I'd say Italy or Spain.
Yes.
That's a great question. But Italy or Spain, I mean, I grew up in central Germany with my dad, but I'm not a fan of Germany and Germans.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the Italian, the Spanish. They're more lively people, you know.
Yeah, the food's better.
So tell us about what it's like landing and taking off in a helicopter. And were you ever looking for pilots who had bailed out? What sort of thing would you do?
So the answer to the second part of the question is yes. That was what I did most of my flying in the Navy was what we called search and rescue or combat search and rescue. And if it was wartime and people are shooting at you, I also did some anti-submarine warfare and a lot of logistics stuff. Logistics because everything from carrying people and mail and parts from one ship to another. But it could be it could also be things like medevacs and other things, photo missions and stuff like that. One of the more entertaining ones that we did is I was a brand new lieutenant, which is an O3, same as a captain in the Army and Marine Corps and Air Force. And they sent us into the Black Sea to go take pictures of Soviet ships, new Soviet ships. And the goal was to get close, to get really good close-up pictures. So to me, that was like carte blanche. To hover alongside, a half a rotor distance away from a Soviet ship and take pictures of them, or let the photographer in the back take pictures of them. So the first part of this thing is that I primarily flew off what we call non-aviation ships, mostly destroyers and cruisers. The designations changed over time. I did fly a fair amount off an aircraft carrier, and it's different than flying off a small ship. And the big difference is the air landing, the helipad in the back is much smaller. And also these ships have a tendency to pitch and roll a whole lot more. I've actually landed on the back end of a destroyer that was rolling 15 to 20 degrees and the fantail where the helideck was located is going up about 15 to 20 feet. It tends to focus one's attention. I've also landed on ships where the tip of the rotor blade to the superstructure of ship clearance is less than 3 feet. So again, I've done that day and night. And again, it has a tendency to focus one's attention. Well, operating off a carrier is a lot different. You got a lot more room But there are a whole lot more constraints, strangely enough, because the carrier is there to launch and recover fixed wing airplanes. So flying helicopters is just, we're a nuisance, because they got to get us off the deck to go do whatever we're going to do, whether it's plane guard, go someplace else or whatever. And then, oh yeah, we got everybody, all the fixed wing guys aboard. We ought to get the helicopter aboard. By that time, the carrier is off and turning out of the wind, and the Lord only knows what you got. In terms of wind direction, sometimes it's okay. Sometimes you can literally be out of limits to shut the helicopter's rotors down. But on the small ships, the captains were typically delighted to have us on board. And we told them we wanted the wind of 30 degrees to port and starboard. That's pretty much what we got. The other part of it is that we also had to train them not to do what they call blowing stacks, which is cleaning out the stacks that exhaust the burn gases from the engines, and which sometimes have a pretty nasty taste. They're highly corrosive quite often, and they cause their own amount of turbulence.
This is a loaded question, but did anyone at any point in your Navy career attempt to use a firearm or other weapon in order to shoot down your aircraft?
Not, hopefully not a U.S. guy, but yes, I've been shot at by the North Vietnamese, by the Iraqis. So the answer to your question is yes.
Yes. And the weapon of choice, was it the AK-47 they would carry, or was it the larger 12.7 millimeter?
That's also an interesting question. It's mostly small arms. Whether it was a machine gun or an AK, the Soviets had, or the North Vietnamese had, these things called the RPDs and something else, RP something else. It was essentially fired the same cartridge that was the Mosin Nagant rifle from World War I actually fired. And they were all over the place. The weapon we feared the most was the Soviet 12.7 millimeter machine gun, because it's like a 50 cal, and it can really rip up your helicopter in a hurry. What was interesting is when they shot at us with small arms aimed at three parts of the helicopter: the cockpit, the area around the transmission, which is and the engines, and the tail rotor section, because helicopters are incredibly vulnerable to small arms fire, particularly if you're flying ones like I did, which is the H2 and the H3, which were not designed to be ballistically tolerant at all. The H3 was designed for anti-submarine warfare, and the H2 is designed as a utility helicopter to fly around the carrier task force. So we being the Navy, added armor, self-sealing tanks, armored seats, some defensive weapons, but in the H3, hydraulic failure meant you were essentially out of control because you couldn't fly the helicopter at all.
What sort of protection did you have? Were you sitting on a metal piece of metal that would stop bullets and shrapnel?
No,
you were not. No,
we had armored seats that were made out of, I was told, some kind of boron epoxy. It was about 3/4 to 1 inch thick. We had little wings that you could flip out, so you could, you know, cover more of you. And then it was in the back and on the bottom, but your legs were fully exposed. Sometimes we had chicken plates, which was the ceramic armor that the infantry or the soldiers carried. Most times we put that down in the chin bubble, which is down below your feet, because when you're flaring, that's, you know, where they're going to shoot at the cockpit, because that's what they can see. And then as you're taking off and your nose low, again, they're going to be shooting at the cockpit. So that's one of the places they're going to see. Plus the fact, me personally, I was just terrified of being pinned in the helicopter if we crashed, because if that thing's around your chest and you land hard, it could come up and hit you in the chin and knock you out.
So what would you tell a young person who decided that he says, you know, I want to fly helicopters off of destroyers and frigates, and this looks like a fantastic career, saving people, bringing equipment to the Navy. What would you tell him? How would you get him completely motivated and ready for his training or her training? And women, quite a few women pilots.
Yeah, about half the current helicopter pilots in the Navy right now are females. In fact, we probably have the largest percentage of female pilots in the Navy and by community. I would say maybe even, yeah, I would say half the as we'd call them, rotorheads, are women. That's a great question. Let me go back to this. A more basic point. I wanted a set of wings, Navy wings. I started out wanting to fly fighters.
Sure.
I was voluntold to fly helicopters. I was furious at the time that I was assigned to fly helicopters. And it took me probably 15 years in my career to realize that, hey, I'm doing something that's really special. But my advice to kids is going into the training command is do the best that you can, because everything is graded. Okay. The goal is not getting into fighters. The goal is not getting into PH or patrol airplanes or helicopters. The goal is getting a set of wings. As late as about 5 years ago, when I had saw some figures, the attrition rate's still pretty healthy. It's north of 40 or 50%. So, it's a very intense one a year, 12, 15 months, something like that program. And it requires a lot of dedication and commitment. And if you aren't willing to do that, don't. Okay. And the second thing is the goal is to get a set of wings. What you wind up flying is sort of in your control, but not entirely in your control. And then once you get to that community, enjoy it. Do the best you can. The Navy now allows you to change communities once in your career after your first tour. So if you get assigned to fly helicopters like I did, and I wanted to go fly fighters, they send you to the through a training program that enables you to qualify in F-18s. They didn't when I went through, but beginning in the 80s and 90s, they began to realize that was a retention issue. I start allowing a community change. It has a lot of implications from career development, competitiveness with your peers. And so the Navy had to work through a lot of those other issues. It wasn't just simply saying, oh, I'm done flying H-60s. I want to go fly F-18s. It's a far much more complicated issue than that. But they figured it out, and now you can do it without a penalty. It adds a sea tour to your, which means lots of deployments, to your career path.
When you got off of active duty, did you use fly any commercial aviation, airplanes and all that?
Well, I flew as a corporate pilot for a couple of years, and I was in the aviation industry for many years. When I had my first chance to go into the airlines, we had this thing called an oil and gas crisis in the 70s. And so the airlines weren't hiring. They were laying people off. And then the next couple of times I was at a point in my life where I could go to the airlines, so to speak. It just wasn't open. And then also the financial penalties were pretty severe. So even today, well, back in those days, I would go from making $70,000, $80,000 a year to $10,000 or $15,000 a year. And that just, as a non-starter. So I flew as a corporate pilot for 3 years. I loved it. I was never home, which is the reason I went into the consulting business. And again, I wasn't home, but at least I was on a more regular basis home or had travel plans. But corporate flying to me was a hoot, because you'd leave with some passengers in the back and you were on your own. And we went all over the world, literally. And once you took off, you and your the guy you were flying with, and if you would care, a flight attendant, sometimes we did. It was just the three of us in an airplane and a credit card.
Yeah, and a credit card.
Somebody else's credit card, by the way.
Yeah. I'm really quite amazed, because the people who are listening should understand that you've written a total of 11 books, and I'm sure dozens and dozens of articles for, you know, like Navy Times and things like that. But tell us about the discipline it takes to be a good writer. And you are a good writer, and I actually intend to get some of your books. I think you're interested. We have the same gene pool there.
Super. Well, thanks. So here's what I tell people who want to become writers. It takes patience, discipline, and a thick skin. And so let me explain why those. Number one, the patience is because a manuscript of 100,000 words doesn't occur overnight. It takes me anywhere from 3 to 6 months if I'm familiar with the topic. So some of the books that I've written, like the first Age of Sail book, took me almost 15 months to write the first one because of the research required. So it doesn't happen overnight. And also the publishing process takes time. So literally I delivered my third book of my Age of Sail to a publisher last Friday, and it'll probably be out sometime in August. July, August is kind of where we're shooting at. It depends on the editing process and a whole bunch of other things, but there are just some other nature issues in the process. So you have to be patient. And then they also have to be patient. As, you know, you want to get it, like doing interviews. Sometimes they occur quite rapidly. Sometimes they take forever. Like I was, this last round, I was trying to schedule things on the latest release, and there's some in April. Discipline. I sit down at my desk, or my wife refers to as my garret, every day. When I say every day, at least 6 days, 5 to 6 days a week. And I work at my craft. Now I could either be creating a new manuscript. I could be editing a new, an existing manuscript, or I can be reading changes or requested changes to a manuscript. And I do that for at least 4 or 5 hours every day. And then the afternoons are spent working on what I call the PR aspects of this, which is the promotion side. Sure. So it takes discipline to do those things literally every day, and persistence. And then the last thing is, like I said, is persistence, because you hear the word the thick skin, because you hear the word no a lot. It took me almost 2 years, maybe longer than that, to get my first book published. And I had a long string of freelance articles that I could show, point to people, but everybody said, that's articles and that's history. Yeah. And this is a novel and it's different. Oh, well, yeah, it is. Mm. The publisher is going to invest in you, particularly as a new author. So it requires a fair amount of stick-to-itiveness. And it also requires a knowledge of the business world. So this is the other thing that this is the big aha about being an author. The three things that you do as an author, one, write the manuscript. That's the easiest, strange enough. The second thing is finding a publisher. So now I keep trying to keep two publishers happy. I'm pretty much out of trying to find a publisher game, but I have the scars and the t-shirts and hats to share with people who want to understand what I went through, particularly the first time. Then, and by the way, that also includes those lessons learned also includes things like contracts with the publisher and includes promotional deals and stuff like that. So anyway, so I come back to this whole idea about persistence and a thick skin. You get told no a lot. It's just as simple as that, particularly when you're trying to sell your first novel. Mm. And you're going to get told no by magazines who don't want to review your book. And you're going to get told no by, because I do a fair amount of public speaking, which is a way I promote my books. And I get told no a lot. So, you know, you got to just have a thick skin and deal with it and move on.
Are you also a motivational speaker? Or do you do that sort of thing? You might be very good at that, by the way.
Yeah, I'm not so much. I don't call myself a motivational speaker.
No.
Although I should. I talk on topics that are not only of interest to me, but other people. So if you look at my speaking side of the website, I do one on leadership, which actually I've been paid to do a lot. It's called The Dirty Dozen of Leadership. And it's pretty popular. I also get paid occasionally to talk about foreign affairs and how to become published or how to write a novel. I do a fair amount of coaching in that for three different associations who have of military aviators, because my view is if we don't tell our stories, nobody else will. And if they do tell them, they're going to get it wrong. So And then the last thing I talk about is foreign affairs, what I call living history. And living history, literally, most of it comes out outgrowth of stuff that I've researched. But people call me on the phone and say, hey, Mark, we really like to have you come talk. We've heard you before. Can you talk about this? Boom. If I can do it, I'll do the research and do it. Other speeches come out of articles that I've written. The Mustang versus Corsair, Wildcat versus Zero. All those two have come out of articles I've written. There's a couple others. And so that's how a lot of the speaking comes about. And then some people pay me. If it's a small association like a Rotary Club, no. But if you're a business or a large association, you want me to come speak for 45, 50 minutes and take questions, the answer is yes. Get out your checkbook.
Yeah, I've been in that world, and it's a great way to make money and
yes.
Be very much engaged with people, and you've got to be really on your toes. Well, I really want to let you know how much I appreciated this, because there are so many people out there who are thinking, you know what? I know I could write a book. I know I could write a book. And what they need to hear before they start is, you got to be committed. You need a thick skin, and it's all discipline, discipline, discipline. So I think you've given us something to think about, certainly me and the others, because these podcasts, they sort of go in perpetuity. You know, you pay a fee and they stay there. So yep. When you and I are gone, people are going to be listening to this saying, what are these guys doing?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. Maybe just her family, but
yeah, our descendants. And that, by the way, that's strange enough one of the reasons why I've written some of the books, because in many ways it's stuff for my grandkids and great grandkids and stuff like that. Even though I tell people I'm immortal and I have proof, you know, the reality is I may not be around for, you know, a lot longer. So it is, you know, what is my legacy to my children, one of my legacies to my grandkids.
Yeah, time marches pretty quickly. Well, keep up the good work, and I look forward to meeting you in person one of these days, but thanks again for your wisdom, your wit and wisdom.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.